The following previews are of Graphic Audio Productions, rated for mature audiences due to scenes of intense violence and sexual situations.
Kyler Stern has rejected the assassin's life.
We've got a contract for you. 50,000 Gunders for one kill, Kyler. With that much, you can take Aline annually anywhere. You'll have done the world a good turn, and you'll never have to work again. It's just one last job.
There's always one last job. I'm finished.
The God King's successful coup has left Kyler's master, Derzo Blint, dead and buried.
Oh, I've been having a little party, celebrating.
What are you celebrating?
Derzo Blint is dead!
Tired of it all, he is starting over. New city, new friends, and a new profession.
Kyler, there are always going to be people so bad that we think they deserve to die. I don't know. What I do know is what you've told me about what killing has done to your soul. No matter what good it seems to do for the world, it destroys you. I can't watch that, Kyler. I won't. I care about you too much.
All right. We should be able to leave in the morning.
But the beckoning will of the Shadow soon comes to call on Kyler once again.
Logan's alive. He's in the hole.
Logan's alive?
Every day, the chances that Logan will be discovered get worse.
You want me to break into the hole and save Logan?
I want you to rescue Logan. And then I want you to assassinate the God King.
Kyler is faced with an agonizing choice. Will he give up the Way of Shadows and live in peace? Or will he risk everything by taking on the ultimate hit?
Look at yourself! I know this hit is impossible! I'm sending you after a god! But if anyone in the world can do it, it's you! You were made for this, Kyler. Some things are bigger than your happiness. You can give hope to an entire nation!
It'll only cost me everything.
Will Kyler see the light when his world is shrouded in shadows? Find out in Shadow's Edge, the thrilling second part of the Night Angel trilogy. Available now in Graphic Audio.
It's good to have you back, my friend.
It's bad to be back.
Available now in Graphic Audio.
Many years ago, my people, the Togairu, were conquered by the Berenice. It is a situation that cannot be allowed to continue.
I know the tale. You are to be ranger in Togai, then.
That is the land I know. I understand the ways of the great oxen and the high tundra lions, of the black diamond serpent and the wild horses. Never did I doubt that my tenure with the Tuelafar would end with my return to Togai, my land, my home, my love.
No! You must run! All of you get out, or you're all going to die! Get out! Now!
You disgrace your father! You bring dishonor to your name, and tragedy to those who brought you in to care for you!
It was an accident!
It was the logical conclusion to your reckless course! The inevitable result of who you are, Adrian Windon, and the proof that you are no ranger, and never shall be one!
Were I to raise an army tomorrow, I would turn it upon Anderblock Innes and raise the valley. I would see Lady Dasseron and every one of her taunting kin dead in the grass.
Bear witness, ye all, for on this midsummer day of God's year 840, does Gilsepony Windon take the surname of Ursel. Hail to the Queen!
Hail to the Queen!
Don't miss The Demon Wars Saga Book 5, Ascendance Part 1. Available now in Graphic Audio. And now, our feature presentation.
Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Jerry Ahern's The Survivalist. Narrated by Terrence Aselford, with performances by Mort Shelby, Nanette Savard, M.B. Van Dorn, Eric Messner, Michael Glenn, Dylan Lynch, Ren Casey, Tom Simpson, Jeff Baker, Stephen Carpenter, Michael John Casey, David Coyne, Colleen Delaney, Ken Jackson, Elizabeth Jernigan, Sonny Lasky, Thomas Penny, and Richard Rowan. Survivalist, The Legend, Part 1. German gunships closed tight around his own craft. John Rourke wheeled the captured Soviet machine 180 degrees on its main rotor axis and fell into the center of the formation. Flak, fired from mobile anti-aircraft batteries, exploded around them. Shoulder-fired surface-to-air missiles filled the sky. Several of the German gunships were already damaged, one of them aflame. But the formation held, all aircraft still aloft. They flew over an ice field that stretched in all directions below them as far as Rourke could see. German J-7V vertical takeoff and landing fighter bombers with fresh coatings of Arctic camouflage screamed out of the snow-heavy clouds from the north and across the airfield in high-speed, low-altitude strafing runs. The Allied goal was to keep as much as possible of the massive Elite Corps installation at Guriev, where the Ural River met the Caspian Sea, intact, so that once taken, the field and its extensive synth fuel dumps could be used as a staging area for the impending Allied assault on the Soviet underground city in the Ural Mountains. This thrust, in conjunction with a simultaneous attack on the Soviet underwater facility in the Pacific, if successful, would be the last battle of a war that raged across the planet for more than five centuries. From the main portion of the fuselage behind him, albeit well back from the cockpit, John's son Michael and John's friend Paul Rubinstein reloaded their weapons. The four of them, Michael, Paul, John, and Natalia Anastasia Chemarovna, commandeered the Soviet gunship after completing their sabotage mission on the base prior to the attack. Below, visible through the Soviet gunship's chin bubble, the main helicopter hangar, the smaller hangar that housed Soviet fighter bombers, and the field's main control tower all lay in fiery ruins. In the co-pilot seat beside John Rourke, Natalia Chemarovna removed the short blonde wig she wore when they infiltrated the base disguised as Soviet Elite Corps personnel. Her real hair beneath the wig, so dark a brown it was almost a true black, cascaded to her shoulders. She shook her hair free, then put the headset back to her ear and resumed tuning the frequency scanner on the radio. Their eyes met. Rourke made a conscious effort to look away from Natalia and back to what he should be looking at, the controls of the helicopter.
John, listen! It's Sam! I'll put this on speaker!
Natalia had picked up transmissions from the commando teams that went after Guriev's primary anti-aircraft batteries. The teams led by Major Otto Hammerschmidt of New Germany and U.S. Marine Corps Captain Sam Aldridge of Midwake were still on the ground. She put Aldridge's call to New Germany's Supreme Commander Wolfgang Mann on the speaker.
Say again. Knockout 1 to Snowbird Leader. We have total control of Objective Alpha. Say again. Total control of Objective Alpha. Over.
Knockout 1, this is Snowbird Leader. Knockout 2 reports similar results. Can you hold your position? Over.
Snowbird Leader, this is Knockout 1. Resistance minimal. We can hold, but would appreciate air support against platoon strength enemy unit approaching rapidly from map coordinates G15. Need that ASAP. Enemy unit is armed with at least one energy weapon, and we are currently receiving moderately heavy incoming mortar fire. Please advise. Knockout 1 over.
Rourke took up Natalia's headset.
Snowbird Leader, this is Rourke in Soviet helicopter KHR-333-658. We can interdict enemy forces at coordinates G15 if Knockout 1 can talk us in. Over.
Yes, Herr Doctor, but do you copy this, Knockout 1? Over.
Affirmative, Snowbird Leader. We can talk the Doctor in. Over.
Very well, Doctor. Snowbird Leader out.
Sam, ETA's about 2 minutes. Over.
I copy that, Doctor. Knockout 1 out.
Rourke out.
John handed back the headset.
Can I change frequencies for a minute? I want to hear what else is going on.
Sure.
Michael leaned over between their seats.
Gonna try the energy weapon, Dad?
That's what I'm thinking, Mike.
John called his son by his nickname perhaps 3 times in his life. Michael clapped him on the shoulder.
John, after that energy pulse we took a couple of minutes ago, you think the wiring can stand to use the energy weapon we have aboard?
As best I can tell, the rotation of the main rotor is constantly recharging the power supply, Paul. We should be all right, even on emergency power as we are, because the system shouldn't interconnect.
All I wanted to know...
Rourke put the machine into a climb and banked to starboard, clearing the other helicopters. The J-7Bs moved out to the south, the lead elements of the attack formation already maneuvering into position for a second strafing run, but selective this time, in support of the paratroopers once the men touched down. Already through the overhead bubble, Rourke could see the first of the chutes open in the sky well above their machine. Many of these parachutists weren't parachutists at all, only drones, similar in concept and purpose to those used by the Allies during pre-dawn portions of the D-Day invasion in June of 1944, near the close of World War II. Articulated dummies, miniaturized to perfect scale with their smaller parachutes, they were airdropped in conjunction with actual paratroopers, providing a greater number of targets to draw fire from enemy personnel on the ground. They cut the number of real casualties and deceived the enemy into believing he faced a larger force. More chutes opened. Rourke increased the Soviet machine's speed so he could clear the area before any of the chutes got too close.
I'm switching back to Sam's frequency, John.
Paul and I can set up door guns.
Go for it.
Rourke checked his compass coordinates.
Get Sam to talk us in on that enemy platoon.
Natalia to Knockout One. Natalia to Knockout One. Come in, Knockout One.
As Natalia worked to raise Sam, Rourke began descending, following the terrain to minimize the enemy's chances for establishing visual contact.
John! Stay on current course. We should be over their position in 30 seconds. The Soviet platoon is advancing from 300 meters due east.
Rourke activated the gunship's heads-up display, searching for the correct map grid, then made a mental fix on the relative position of the advancing enemy platoon. He locked the auto-navigator system on the coordinates. For the first time since leaving the airfield, he looked behind him along the interior of the fuselage. He saw Michael and Paul mounting Soviet heavy machine guns on rotating tripods at either side of the aircraft just inside the open doors. Rourke's eyes flashed to the heads-up display. Auto-navigation was bringing the gunship in along a broad arc from the west to the south that would intersect the enemy unit's assumed line of movement, but he thought of a better idea. John adjusted the unit's controls. No need for his full attention to navigation just yet. The helicopter banked slowly, evenly, to port. Rourke's goal in modifying the flight plan was to come up on the attacking Soviet platoon from the rear. He had no desire to serve as target practice for the enemy energy weapons.
I see them, John!
Rourke nodded. He switched off auto-navigation.
We have a full charge on the energy weapon!
We're ready, John!
Rourke hated war. He thought all rational men did. Violence was the last resort when reason failed. Reason failed dismally in the days immediately prior to the night of the war. Now, 500 years later, as the surviving societies re-emerged, the failure continued. In seconds, he would bring the liberated Soviet gunship screaming in over the heads of men who were to him total strangers, then attempt, with all his abilities and the technology of the aircraft he flew, to cut them down.
I hate this. We're going in!
Rourke banked the Soviet gunship to port, then leveled off as he took control of the energy weapon fire mechanism.
Full power!
Full power!
Below, 3 dozen men, fathers, sons, husbands, who by accident of birth wore enemy uniforms, advanced on the Allied position. The machine guns on both sides of the gunship opened up. Rourke pushed the energy weapon fire control button. Below him seemed to incinerate, bodies vaporized as the blue wave of energy passed across the ground. Rourke pulled up, satisfied the energy weapon in possession of the enemy ground force was no longer functional. He didn't look at anyone as he leveled off and let the machine rotate 180 degrees on its axis. His eyes narrowed and focused on the fleeing enemy forces beneath him. 2/3 of the platoon-strength enemy unit was dead. What remained of their bodies smoldered on the snowy ground beneath him.
You got him, Dr. Rourke! The rest of them are withdrawing!
John switched off the radio speaker.
Enough.
This'll be the stuff of legend if humanity survives.
An army like no other gathered near the entrance to the Soviet underground city in the Urals. Much of the force assembled on a high, snow-covered plain swept by endless icy winds. Perhaps, at some point in human history, larger armies prepared for an ultimate battle.
But not even World War II claimed an alliance this unique.
tanks arrived, swinging on cables beneath large, powerful cargo helicopters. Trucks and armored personnel carriers moved everywhere. Men and equipment collected in such great abundance that he did not attempt to tally. The alliance here was of men, not nations. The men included a unit of Icelandic police, battalions of Germans born and raised under Nazi dictatorship, who, with a taste of freedom, now committed their all to this alliance, a few Americans, Chinese who remained faithful to the sweep of change and democratization that started, then stalled, then split the very fabric of China. Even men from the wild tribes of Europe, not trained in fighting nor skilled in technology, most of them unable to communicate verbally, still did their part by moving crates of ammunition and disposable rocket launchers, aiding in whatever manner they could.
Wish I had time to write all this down.
Instead, he too worked. As time went on in this war, he became something of the expert concerning Soviet computers. On several occasions, he jury-rigged Russian-made instruments because the job needed doing and no one else was available. Now, he worked with Natalia. What Paul witnessed over the landing field, he saw as he took a break to rest his eyes after staring at the green light of the screens for more hours than he wanted to consider.
I think I have it, Paul.
Paul rubbed his aching back, dropped to his knees on the tower floor beside her, and rubbed his bald fists over his eyes. Indeed, it appeared she had at last made the critical connection linking the auto-navigation broadcast system aboard the captured Soviet gunships into the German navigational computer used by the tower controllers. If the system worked, it would be possible, in theory, to track every single Soviet helicopter gunship that would be sent against them on computer, then link that system into missile targeting. The result, a computer operator could locate, track, and destroy each of the Soviet gunships at whim, merely by locking a missile onto each individual gunship's auto-navigation evasion program. By the time the Soviet pilots caught on that their own evasive action was homing the missile onto them, it would be too late. Eventually, the better pilots would realize what was happening, but by that time, it would be too late to save the majority of the Soviet gunships.
You got it. So let's try it out.
He crossed to the other side of their private corner of the tower and took up the radio microphone. Michael flew a Soviet gunship over the ice more than 5 miles downrange.
This is Sitting Duck. Read you loud and clear. I will commence evasive pattern starting now. Sitting Duck out.
Michael punched in the standard Soviet evasion program and watched as his instruments on auto-navigation suddenly seemed to have a mind and will of their own, moving the Soviet helicopter he flew to a higher altitude and commencing a zigzag pattern. On his incoming radar, he saw the predicted missile. The blip appeared very small at first, but grew larger and larger by the microsecond. And the Soviet machine he no longer controlled saw it too. Michael thought of his talk with his father before taking off.
You've gotten pretty good with one of these things, Michael. I'd never think you're too good. Once the missile is on target, and the machine is responding with evasive action, and the missile seems locked on regardless, cut out of the auto-nav mode, dive the machine, and call into Natalia and Paul to give the destruct code for the missile. You don't need that thing crawling up your ass to prove the system works.
I can handle it, Dad.
His father had smiled.
I know you can handle it. Otherwise, you wouldn't be doing it.
Michael didn't quite understand his father's meaning with that remark. John could have meant it several ways. The younger Rourke checked his instruments again. The Soviet gunship was playing its heart out, really. Michael could feel it in his stomach, the climbing, the diving, the rapid direction changes. But the growing blip of the missile still moved inexorably nearer to the center of the green screen with the yellow grid. And the radar screen itself was that center. He decided to hang on a while longer, really giving the new system the test it deserved. If the system worked, countless Allied lives could be saved. For the Soviet gunships would attract the missiles sent to destroy them. Michael watched the blip. It grew larger as it closed on his machine. In his peripheral vision, he saw the snow, the sky just a darker white, and then he saw a contrail.
Sitting Duck to Guardian Angel. Sitting Duck to Guardian Angel. Come in, Guardian Angel. Over.
Michael switched off auto-navigation and canceled autopilot interlock. He pushed the gunship into a high-speed dive.
Sitting Duck to Guardian Angel. Come in, Guardian Angel. Over.
This is Guardian Angel reading you loud and clear, Sitting Duck. Over.
Execute destruct sequence now. I say again, execute destruct sequence now. Over. Damn.
Michael let the missile get too close. He banked the Soviet gunship hard to starboard in a maximum acceleration climb to avoid the consequences of his error in judgment. The missile itself was visible as a blurred streak of darker gray against the sky, a snow-white contrail snaking after it, zigzagging maddeningly but ever nearer. At the high point of his acceleration, Michael dove. The missile streaked past him just over his main rotor. He glanced right. The missile made a near right-angle turn, still homing in. Michael grabbed for his survival knife. It was his only hope. There was something wrong with his auto-navigation system. Had to be. And in another second or two, the missile, still homing in on him, would explode. The concussion, at this range, would be enough to knock Michael's Soviet chopper out of the air. Michael took the knife in his right fist and awkwardly worked the machine's controls with his left. He hammered the butt of the crane knife against the auto-navigation console, smashing it. He wheeled the 9-inch blade knife in his fingers and stabbed into the wiring. The knife flew from his grip. The helicopter's control console sparked and smoked. The missile shot past him as he wrenched the helicopter out of the dive and slipped to port. The missile exploded. The machine rocked, trembling around him. But the controls still worked, though all electronics were dead. The important thing, Michael Rourke thought, smiling, was that he was not. The temperature inside the hermetically sealed tent was comfortable, yet in contrast to the outside temperature, it seemed stiflingly warm. John was entering a moment for which he had waited 500 years. The night of the war came, despite the claims of those who considered themselves wise and informed that peace was at hand, that World War III would never occur. After the night of the war, John had no time to do anything but react. First, he searched for his wife and children, with his unexpected but welcome ally, Paul Rubinstein. Shortly after beginning his search for his family, John met Natalia, and his world changed again. He remembered her from the espionage game they both played out in Latin America on opposite sides. Natalia, too, became his friend, his ally, and something more. He was in love with her, and she with him, but that fact had no bearing on his search for his family. Rourke found them, his wife and children, barely made it into the retreat with them alive before the ionization of the atmosphere took full effect and the sky literally caught fire. Deliberately, while his wife Sarah, his friend Paul, and Natalia too rested through the centuries in cryogenic sleep, Rourke awakened his children, taught them to survive, and returned to the sleep. Rourke looked around the table as his son Michael approached, then sat down. Although everyone told John he and his son looked sufficiently alike to be twins, Rourke only considered that well-meant flattery. Yet, because of the tricks with human aging he played through use of the cryogenic chambers, though their birthdays were decades apart, there was now less than a decade's gap between their actual ages. He looked directly at Michael.
How's your knife?
Didn't get hurt, Dad.
Wolfgang Mann, already seated, turned to Rourke.
Doctor, the meeting is yours.
John nodded to his son, then sat down.
Gentlemen, this will be our last briefing before those few of us who are going inside move out. I don't know the overall attack plan of Colonel Mann, nor do I desire to know it. Should any of us who will be entering the underground city be taken alive, such knowledge could endanger too many others. So this will be a little one-sided. Commando raids will launch simultaneously on the underground city and the Soviet underwater complex just before the main attacks take place. My team and I will be leaving in approximately 15 minutes. It is our intention to penetrate the underground city, using the energy weapons created especially for that purpose, as based on the Soviet technology. Once inside, we will fight our way toward the central control complex, where, according to our most recent intelligence data, we should be able to locate and neutralize both the main entrance controls and the primary radar system that coordinates surface-to-air missile responses. We hope.
Jason Darkwood broke the surface of the lagoon beneath the Soviet undersea city's dome. He cocooned his wings around him. High clouds hung beneath the dome, clouds of water vapor and God only knew what else, clouds that were always there, giving the air above the appearance of sky. But on the other side of the dome was the sea. The entire Soviet complex sat on a ridge beside an undersea volcanic vent providing a geothermal power source. Far away beneath the sea, sharing the same volcanic vent for the same purpose, lay Midwake, the American undersea colony established 5 centuries before, only a moment in history before the night of the war. Jason Darkwood, Captain, United States Navy, commanding United States attack submarine Ronald Reagan, had gambled, and with the 23 U.S. Marines of his commando team, he won. The computer banks of the most recently captured Soviet island-class submarines contained the latest safe route into the lagoon that served as the harbor and central docking area for the Soviet underwater complex. Darkwood gambled that the Soviets would not have had the time to change the route beneath the dome and into the lagoon. There was the possibility the Soviets left the route unchanged as part of a trap, but Jason couldn't figure on the purpose of such a trap, and the risks were great. He could have brought 200 men in with him, or more than that. The Soviet Marine Spetsnaz, who coordinated security for the complex, slipped up. That he made it into the lagoon and stuck his helmet up above the surface without getting his head blown off was concrete evidence. Now, Darkwood was tired of holding his breath. The hemosponge he used to breathe under the water didn't work in atmosphere, and he was as certain as circumstances allowed that he and his men were undetected. So he ducked underwater again, allowing his wings to unfold, then twisted his body into a downward roll toward the shoaled area just beneath the main dock. His 23 commandos waited for him in a wedge-shaped defensive posture, their liberated Soviet shark guns poised and ready. With hand and arm signals, Darkwood communicated that all above seemed well. His plan? Assault the dock, now. The Marine Lieutenant Stanhope from the Reagan and two Marine sergeants broke off toward the other dock ladders, taking five men each. Five men fell in behind Darkwood. Soviet uniforms would give no element of surprise, and certainly no entry to the Soviet underground city in the Ural Mountains, because the Soviets would be using daily issue passes and regularly changed code phrases. Of that, John was sure. With the Allied army camped virtually on their doorstep, they would have been fools to do otherwise. On the plus side, Soviet uniforms would get them to the main entrance unmolested. The system they used was exactly the same that worked successfully for them at Guryev. Paul drove the ATV staff car, Michael sat beside him, Natalia sat on the driver's side in the rear passenger seat, John beside her, all of them in appropriate Soviet uniform attire. The exception this time was that they were more heavily armed, secreted under their rear seat, and behind it were explosives and the four German-made energy weapons. Paul turned the staff car onto the icy road heading toward the outer boundary gate for the underground city. Soviet vehicles surrounded them. Soviet jet fighters and gunships patrolled the sky above them. Jason dropped to his knees behind crates of explosives stacked on the dock. There was a sentry on the dock who wasn't there when he broke the surface for a quick look only moments before. It was imperative now to remove the sentry before the rest of his team surfaced. He shrugged out of his wings and flippers as quickly as he could, no time to shed the rest of his swimming gear. He reached to his side for the Randall Smithsonian buoy, an identical duplicate of the Randall his ancestor brought to Midwake 5 centuries before. But something existed now that didn't then. It was a type of field blue anti-corrosive sealant. It coated the high-carbon steel blade of his knife, killing the shine and protecting it against seawater.
All right, buddy, where'd you go?
Darkwood fisted the knife as he peered around the corner of his little fort of packing crates. The sentry might not be coming back to Jason's position for a few moments, and in that time, the teams would already have begun coming onto the dock. Jason looked quickly up and down the dock, seeing no other signs of guard personnel except those on the docked island-class vessels. But their decks were so high above the docks that if luck were with him, he might not be seen at all. Darkwood gambled again.
Well, here goes.
He moved from the walled structure of ammo crates and along the dockside, moving as quickly and as silently as he could. The Randall tight in his right fist in a rapier hold, ready to chop or thrust. Steel and flesh. The first time he learned the techniques, the idea of using a knife on a man was an abstraction. Unlike most of his fellow Midwake submarine commanders, however, he couldn't sit idly and relatively safely by aboard his vessel while the Marines assigned to him went into man-to-man battle. Therefore, the abstraction became reality for him quite some time ago, and the reality revolted him, more so because he was good at it. The reality approached again as he neared the man he was about to kill. His eyes shifted from the imaginary spot he picked just beyond his target to his knife. He learned in training, one never watched the intended victim. If they succeeded here today and in the hours to come, and if similar success were in the cards for Dr. Rourke and the land forces, then the war would be over. If they failed, Jason and the rest would almost certainly die. There would be much killing.
But why this killing?
Jason rolled the handle of the Randall in his fist, bringing the knife edge upward, just as effective for a thrust into the kidney or a cut to the spine, but even more effective for something else. He remembered watching some of the old mysteries where the heroes, men like Bogart or Cagney, got struck in the head and woke, experiencing no ill effects. That was absurd, at least usually. So what he planned for the Soviet sentry was not all that humane. Days or weeks in a hospital, perhaps side effects, perhaps not. but it would cheat death. Jason was about 3 yards from the man when he quickened his pace. The man turned around. No choice now, no cheating death. Darkwood grabbed the man's face as he raked the knife's primary edge across the throat of the Spetsnaz before the man could cry out. Death got its due.
Shit.
Jason slipped the body into the water. Gloved hands reached up out of the water, taking the body to weight it down with junk from beneath the dock. Paul Rubinstein tapped the front of his greatcoat and felt the small pocket recorder in his breast pocket. Built 500 years ago for dictation, John and Paul nearly wore it out listening to a Beach Boys album during a road trip in a 57 Chevy after the night of the war. The trip ended at a downed jetliner in a battle with brigands, and the drive remained their last, nearly carefree time together. The battle with the brigands was the first of many battles they would face together. For some reason, Paul brought the recorder with them on this mission. Paul slowed the ATV staff car and thought about the recorder.
Another day, if there is one. Perhaps another adventure.
Here I am, the junior editor from a New York magazine turned freedom fighter. All because I got on one airplane instead of another. I survived the night of the war while everyone else in New York City, including my girl and my parents, died in one blinding microsecond. Now I'm married to the daughter of my best friend. She's just a bit younger than me, even though I was born a quarter of a century before her. She's a wonderful, magnificent wife, my Annie Rourke Rubinstein. Now I might lose all I have in her, our future together, but I can't turn away now that we've started.
Paul braked, and the ATV skidded just slightly as it came to a stop near the guard post on the underground city's outer gate. His right hand moved under the skirt of his greatcoat again, but not for the tape recorder. Paul was more heavily armed than he had ever been since he first took up a gun to fight beside John Rourke. That day, 5 centuries ago, John and Paul returned to the crashed jetliner only to find some segments of humanity were not sufficiently glutted on death. They wanted more. The German MP-40 submachine gun, which he still called a Schmeisser because it was now a running joke between John and himself, rested slung under the coat. The battered old Browning high power he took from a pile of brigand weapons after the battle at the jetliner rode with him, as did its newer, less worn twin, which he had acquired later. Aside from the Gerber MK-2 fighting knife he carried, now inside a slit of his greatcoat, he carried 2 other handguns. The newest guns came courtesy of John's stockpile at the retreat, where he and the rest of the family weathered 5 centuries in cryogenic sleep together. What would become of the family now, should this war end today? Natalia loved John, but she would never intentionally come between John and his wife, Sarah. Paul Rubinstein closed his fist over one of the 2 handguns from the retreat. One was a Beretta 92F, originally from the Eden stores, the cache of weapons, materiel, and survival necessities located with strategic reserves in various locations throughout what was once the United States. That was stuffed in his belt beneath his uniform, beside the newer of his 2 Brownings, just a spare for the job at hand. But the other gun, the one he held in his right fist now, was one he decided he would keep. Even if the war ended today, Paul Rubinstein knew he'd become too much of the veteran campaigner to expect that weapons could be melted down into plowshares. The gun was a Smith & Wesson Model 681, the short-lived fixed-sight production version of the 4-inch stainless steel L-frame 357 Magnum. It was another of the many guns John's old pal Ron Mahovsky made up before the night of the war. Metalifed, an electrostatic chrome binding process, over the stainless steel, round, butted to accept Goncalvo Alves combat stocks, action-toned to buttery smoothness. It was perfect for the job at hand. The elite corps guards approached the staff ATV. There were 2 of them. Paul rolled down the staff ATV's passenger window and pointed the gun at them. He fired point-blank into the head of the nearest man, then 2 shots to the chest of the one farthest away. He dropped the revolver onto the seat beside him and stomped the gas pedal, heading off-road to punch through the electrified fence and evade the deflection barriers.
Here we go! Don't touch anything metal!
The ATV seemed to hesitate for a split second. Then it was through. Jason Darkwood was stripped of his environment suit, making a last equipment check on the black penetration suit he wore beneath it. Around him, Marine Raiders were in various stages of shedding their sea wings and environment suits. 2 of Stanhope's men detailed to Darkwood kept watch. PV-26 Shark guns and 24-18 A2 pistols with 30-round magazines at the ready. Darkwood swapped magazines for his pistol, pouching the 15-shot stick and putting the 30 up the well. The chamber already loaded, of course. His knife sheathed to his right leg. Darkwood nodded for the two Marines on guard to get out of their gear while he took the watch. Another Marine, Lance Corporal Mondragon, joined Darkwood at the edge of the packing crate fort. Darkwood rolled back the left cuff of his penetration suit and studied the dual analog digital display of his Steinmetz. They would commence their attack in just under 2 minutes. If all went well, in under 7 minutes, the first U.S. submarine ever to move into the lagoon would start through the entry tunnel, clear it in under a minute more, and surface in the Soviet underwater complex. If all went well. Paul wheeled the staff car along the slope into the hairpin. Natalia, feeling the ATV's rear end skidding, slipping, clutched at John's arm as she started skidding herself along the rear seat.
Hang on.
They were into the curve now, and as she clutched John, she could see out the car's rear window. Two trucks, a half-track, and another staff car pursued them. Soon there would be a helicopter, then another, and another.
Is it time?
They were out of the hairpin. John nodded. Natalia Anastasia Kemarovna, Major, Committee for State Security of the Soviets, retired, took the ridiculous Soviet uniform hat from her head, followed by the short blonde wig. She dropped to her knees beside John, and they pulled the seat out. The first thing she saw was one of the energy weapons. With these, they stood a chance, even against helicopters. And as she looked up through the rear window, she saw the first of the Soviet gunships on its way. As they crossed along the rear of the dock, Jason could see a crane in operation over the missile deck of one of the Soviet island-class submarines, the one at the farthest end of the dock. He could see a warhead disappearing into one of the submarine's missile tubes. The shape and size of the warhead looked considerably different from any Darkwood ever saw before on captured Soviet vessels. And he realized, as a chill ran up his spine, it must be nuclear.
Ah, the damn fools are ready to start it all again, and this time destroy the planet in the process.
Darkwood and his team of Marine Raiders reached the end of the dock. Each sabotage team pursued its own mission. The mission of Darkwood's team was arguably the most difficult and most vital. Capture or destroy the central control complex for the lagoon itself. Once neutralized, the defense systems prohibiting unauthorized entry by submarines into the lagoon would be down. Jason Darkwood longed to see the Reagan's sail rising out of the lagoon, see her reinforced full complement of United States Marines and German long-range mountain patrol and commando personnel swarming across her decks. Each man with his motorized scooter unit would get to the docks and to the decks of the island-class vessels. Darkwood huddled against a wall of crates. They stood larger than the ammunition crates he'd seen before. As if he'd needed the reminder, stenciled on the crates in black and yellow paint, he saw the universal symbol for radioactivity. Nuclear warheads.
Captain, you see? It's...
I see it, Mondragon.
Darkwood nodded, trying to control the mixture of fear and loathing so his voice would not betray his emotions.
They won't get the chance to use them. Trust me on that, son. Move it. Now!
Darkwood hustled his five Marines along toward the gates guarding the dock area of the lagoon, and the high-rise structure just inside the fence. It was the control center. Michael and Natalia unlocked the latches on either side of the roof panel.
Ready, Michael?
Let her go!
They let loose of the panel, and the staff car's slipstream sucked it away. The panel bounced over the trunk lid and onto the ice-slicked road surface behind them. The moonroof was a custom modification to the staff car. Not a standard feature, but under the circumstances, very useful. Natalia helped John fasten the last buckle for the energy weapon's power pack around his chest. Then she squeezed back against the door so she could give John more room. He rose to his full height, threading through the opening in the roof, dragging the energy weapon with him. Natalia twisted herself around and wrestled open the door. The slipstream caught her hair. She clawed at the seat, pushing it out through the open doorway. The ATV bumped as it rolled over it. From under her greatcoat, she pulled the German submachine gun, the sling still wrapped over her body beneath her coat. She stabbed the submachine gun through the open door. Men clinging to the superstructure of the vehicle running near them returned fire. Natalia drew back.
Look out! Grenade outgoing!
Natalia glanced behind her for a split second, catching a quick glimpse of Michael hanging out the passenger side door, pitching the grenade. The grenade hit the roadbed and rolled under the front of the APC she swapped shots with. The APC lost a tread as it careened toward the shoulder. Men fell off onto the roadbed. The vehicles behind the lead APC did not swerve to avoid casualties, but ran over the hapless troopers.
Let's see if this works!
Natalia watched a tongue of bluish-white energy like a lightning bolt move toward the staff car behind them. The staff car exploded. A fireball, black and orange and yellow, belched skyward, then engulfed the APC that drove through it. Soviet security focused its attention on the gates themselves, but Darkwood and his five commandos were already inside the fence. They hustle to the stairs leading up to the Harbormaster's tower. From there, as best intelligence indicated, specialists controlled the sonar net and the sharks guarding the area outside the new sonar-free tunnel.
Attention!
Admiral Ron stepped to the podium.
Be seated. Thank you, Captain Darkwood. Our latest information on security measures you'll encounter in entering the Soviet underwater city indicates the Soviets continue to control sharks electronically to secure their perimeter. They use them much like sentry dogs we've all seen in video movies from before the night of the war. Now, unlike those dogs, however, the sharks are, literally, controlled. They both alert their masters of an incoming diver, then attack and devour that diver. Captain Darkwood will lead a Marine team through the sonar tunnel the Soviets maintain in their surveillance network roughly here. The tunnel exists so the sharks can enter and leave without putting the entire sonar net on alert. Now, though the tunnel allows for sharks to pass, it's too small for any ship. Now, we believe control for the movement of the sharks and the sonar net itself is based in the tower here, inside this dome. Captain Darkwood and his team will gain control of the tower and disable the security net. Then American vessels will enter beneath the Soviet domes and surface in the lagoon, a special surprise for our Soviet friends. We could simply destroy the tower, but the element of surprise is critical to any hope for success against the superior numbers within the Soviet domes. Our overall plan is to seize the submarine bays, block access to the docks from within the domes, and set up a perimeter defense to block any island-class submarines on patrol from getting back inside. We then form a cordon sanitaire through which mid-wake vessels can travel, bringing in more and more troops, most of these German, eventually taking the city block by block if need be. We cannot rule out the chance the Soviet masters would detonate explosives and collapse the domes, destroying not only our attacking forces, but themselves.
Jason neared the steps leading up into the tower. There were two guards stationed at the base with AKM-96 rifles at port arms. It was serious business even to consider firing a conventional weapon beneath the Soviet domes. Catastrophic damage could result. Midwake engineers perfected an effective anti-personnel round that would not penetrate the dome material itself, but there was nothing to suggest the Russians had a similar round. Only the direst circumstances could justify one of these sentries opening fire. However, 9mm Lancer caseless rounds would not penetrate the dome material, or at least that was what the engineers said. Indeed, no handgun round could, not even the 44 Magnum. A single penetration in the domes might not bring a catastrophe, but if the penetration hit at an architectural stress point, or there were several such penetrations, one of the domes might fracture. Then they would all go, and the sea would rush in. The suddenly compressed air would rupture the domes, a natural and human disaster. With no suppressed pistols available, the only solution to the problem of the two guards was the PV-26 shark guns, or knives. The shark guns were relatively silent, but not silent enough, with more Marine Spetsnaz personnel dangerously close by. Darkwood handed off his pistol to a young Marine near him. He carefully drew the Randall from his leg sheath, gestured with his knife toward the two guards, then looked from man to man. All five Marines quietly drew their issue blades by way of volunteering. Despite the circumstances, Jason Darkwood smiled. But he wasn't surprised. After all, the men with him were United States Marines. The wind, unremitting, biting cold, numbed the back of his neck and tore at his hair as he stood in the ATV's roof opening, the energy weapon locked in both fists. John Rourke fired the energy weapon. There was a hum, a crackle, but there was no recoil, no pushing back against him, nor was there any muzzle rise. Accuracy from the hip was outstanding. The APC was there one instant and gone in a ball of flames the next. He twisted the weapon up as the Soviet gunships tried to outflank them. It was a classic Soviet maneuver, and an effective one. Once both machines were in position, a matter of seconds, they would most likely fire their inboard missiles. The objective? Shatter their target between the tandem explosions. John doubted they'd perfected tactical use of the energy weapons with which they were doubtlessly armed. Doubted they would try the same tactic. But John had no intention of waiting to find out. He swung the energy weapon to his shoulder. The design wasn't perfect yet, but he did the best he could, steadying himself as he squeezed the trigger, only a crude switch. The bolt of plasma energy lightning lashed out and up toward the Soviet gunship on his left. It missed. But the gunship drew back. Submachine gun fire erupted from the car. Natalia fired at the choppers as well, either that or Michael using Paul's MP-40. The second chopper fired a missile. Rourke threw the upper half of his body flat over the car's roof, protecting his face and chest as best he could, and at the same time covering the energy weapon. A shower of dirt and debris crashed over him. The car swerved maddeningly. Rourke raised himself up.
Steady me! Steady me!
John felt Natalia's hands on his thighs and hips as he wedged himself into a corner of the roof opening, bracing himself. Rourke fired and missed again. It wasn't just the bumpiness. John realized the sights were off as he turned the weapon in his hands.
Let go of me and duck!
He threw himself forward on the roof again, protecting the weapon and his face as another missile streaked toward the car. The entire fabric of the staff car pulsed. Rourke's squinted eyes flashed to the energy weapon's rear sight. A screw had worked out, and the sight blade slid all the way left.
Damn it!
There was no time to secure another of the energy weapons from inside the car. The next missile strike would have them, and the first chopper was coming back.
Hold me again!
Rourke felt Natalia's hands on him once more as he wedged himself into the corner of the roof opening.
Rear sight be damned.
He swung the weapon to his shoulder like a shotgun, settling the front sight on the center of the chopper and firing, then firing again on the same breath. The helicopter was suddenly aflame, the fireball rushing toward the roof of the staff car.
Holy shit!
Rourke twisted and threw himself down. He wrapped his arms around Natalia to protect her, lest the fireball be sucked in through the open driver's side rear door. The car rocked. Rourke's skin washed hot, then cold. He was up and grabbed the energy weapon again. Natalia steadied him as he swung the weapon to his shoulder and fired on the first helicopter, catching the machine at the tail rotor. The tail seemed to melt, then a line of flame ran from the tail into the fuel tanks. The fireball belched. Rourke threw himself down again, the staff car almost upended with the concussion. John held Natalia against him and looked up. No more choppers.
We're almost at the main gate, John!
Rourke twisted around, still holding Natalia. He focused on the entrance to the underground city. This was the moment. Darkwood slithered beneath the open steps. He could see the feet of the two guards. The young Marine beside him, Lance Corporal Mondragon, looked at him. Darkwood raised the palm of his free hand toward Mondragon, gesturing for patience. Jason looked along the steps. When he and Mondragon left the other three Marines, the guards were standing by the base of the steps, easier prey. But while Darkwood and the Corporal circled around the tower's legs to get at the guards, they moved. Now, one stood on the lowest step, leaning against the handrail, the other on a step about midway along the length of the upward run. Jason signaled to Mondragon to wait until he made his play. Darkwood sheathed the randle, flexed his shoulders, and jumped. He jumped only a few inches, resisting the impulse to go for the next higher step, knowing that the vibration might alert the men he stalked. He swung there, waiting for something to happen. Nothing did. He started climbing, hand over hand, up step to step. His old injuries from New Germany plagued him as he moved. Not all his muscles were back in tone, and some of his wounds were not fully healed. But Jason kept climbing, slowly, his hands on the same tread as the farther away of the two guards now. The man moved on the metal step, started to turn around. Darkwood held his breath, hoping the guard would not look down and back to see gloved hands on the same step on which he stood, and that Lance Corporal Mondragon would not overreact, opening fire or in some other way trying to take out the guard. Darkwood hung there, his fingers stiffening, his shoulders and the horseshoe muscles of his upper arms screaming at him. The guard shifted, and there was no more movement. Jason waited for another few seconds, then began again to climb, running out of strength, but moving as quickly as he could. He reached the landing, shifted his left hand to the landing surface, then his right, then chinned himself with considerable difficulty. He glanced up along the second set of steps. He saw no movement from the door leading into the Harbormaster's Tower, but knew full well someone could be inside, just beyond one of the many windows, watching the loading of the island-class submarines, perhaps grabbing a cigarette. If such a person looked down, Darkwood was toast. Darkwood pushed up silently, slid beneath the handrail, and rose into a crouch. He softly drew the Randall Smithsonian buoy. On the balls of his feet now, keeping to the side of the steps along the near handrail to minimize any possible creak from the steps themselves, Jason Darkwood started down, the buoy in a rapier hold, his left hand outstretched. He was counting on Mondragon's training coming to the fore. If it were Sam Aldridge waiting down there, Sam would know what to do. But Sam was in Europe, fighting with the midway contingent of the Allied force attacking the Soviet stronghold in the Ural Mountains. Would Mondragon have the presence of mind to wait for the precise instant that Darkwood attacked the guard at the middle of the steps? Would he then attack the guard at the steps' base? Darkwood focused his concentration on the point of his knife, admiring its symmetry, the blade geometry that gave it strength. The trick was to focus the mind on anything besides the man you approached. Somehow, it almost made one a believer in extrasensory perception. It seemed that by concentrating on the target was alerted. He was two steps up behind the man he was about to kill. There was no choice but to look at him now, the exact position of the sentry's rifle, how to counter the gun dropping or firing, all the nuances of the strike. Darkwood jumped, circled the man's face with his left arm, jerked his head back, and with his right arm, drove the blade into the victim's spine to kill as quickly as he could. Darkwood's wrist moved with a vibration as steel met bone. Pain moved up Darkwood's right forearm. The dead man made no sound. Darkwood left the knife where it was and grabbed the body. The guard just below turned, and Darkwood started to grab for the dead Marine Spetsnaz's Stai 20 dart gun. But Mondragon had the second sentry. His hand over the man's mouth, he drove the blade into the chest, drew it out again, and slit the soldier's throat. As Mondragon dragged the sentry down, Darkwood eased his man onto the steps. Darkwood looked toward the landing and up along the length of steps toward the door to the Harbormaster's Tower.
So far, so good.
The main gates were reinforced, with deflection barriers before them, and there was no way to drive around either. John Rourke twisted round, getting as low as possible to the staff car's roofline as he aimed the energy rifle toward the gate.
On three! One!
There was a specially built platform that folded out of the passenger side front door, forming a step. Michael was on that step now, behind the armor-plated door, armed identically to John.
Two!
The idea was a simple one, like the entire plan. Blast down the deflection barrier and the gate behind it, then get inside.
Three!
John and Michael fired for the center of the deflection barrier. Streams of blindingly blue light moved as bolts from their weapons. They fired again, both of them aiming for the same spot in the deflection barrier. The center of the synth concrete barricade smoldered. The Rourkes fired still again. The deflection barrier shimmered where the beams hit it.
Keep firing continuously until it goes!
Their wonder weapons weren't destroying the synth concrete of the deflection barrier, and Paul wouldn't be able to turn the staff car to avoid it. John and Michael kept firing, feeling their power packs strapped to their backs starting to warm. The barrier glowed. Vehicles behind it exploded. Metal fence struts just beyond it melted. A group of Soviet Elite Corps personnel literally threw themselves across the barricade, firing automatic weapons. Paul swerved the staff car. John swung the muzzle of the energy weapon left, blazing a trail with the energy stream. Michael swung around too, and Natalia opened up with her submachine gun from below. Bullets whined off the deflection barricade. Two of the Elite Corpsmen went down. The beam from Rourke's energy weapon struck two of the men, their bodies torched for an instant, then vaporized. Michael and John turned their energy weapons back on the barricade, the staff car mere meters from it. The deflection barrier seemed to glow brighter. There was a crack louder than the heaviest caliber rifle shot John Rourke ever heard, and the glow turned into an arc as the synth concrete barrier exploded.
We're going through!
Bullets zinged and whined off the staff car's coachwork. What was left of the glass in the vehicle shattered. John swung the muzzle of the energy weapon in his hands towards the Elite Corps personnel and fired. The remaining four Marine Raiders light-footed up the steps, their Soviet AKM-96s ready. Once inside the Harbormaster's Tower, guns could be fired with relative impunity, but the noise would alert Marine Spetsnaz personnel nearby of an attack. That was to be avoided, if at all possible, lest the Allies lose the element of surprise. Darkwood stood ready on the right side of the door at the height of the steps, Lance Corporal Mondragon on the left. The lead man of the four Marines returned Darkwood's pistol. Jason press-checked the slide, confirming the chamber was loaded. He gave the nod as the last of the Marine Raiders took his place. Mondragon and one of the other men readied their rifles. Three of the Marines carried specially prepared gas grenades. Mondragon laced a strip of black adhesive against the door lock, connecting power leads to the battery pack brought up by one of the other four Marines. It was an offshoot of the technology used by the terrestrial Soviets in the construction of their energy rifles. The same plasma energy could be used to melt the lock plate on the doorway. Darkwood carefully stepped over the railing, down two steps along the outside. He watched as Mondragon powered up and turned to the three grenadiers.
Be ready. Masks up.
Darkwood and the team pulled their gas masks from the bags at their sides, snapped them over their faces, and popped their cheeks, making seals. The door's lock plate fell away.
Grenades!
Each of the three Marines with the gas grenades hurled a pair of the grenades. Rifles ready now from the three grenadiers, Darkwood and Mondragon and the sixth man broke through the doorway, Sti 20 pistols in hand. Darkwood fired one of the Soviet dart pistols point blank into the chest of a burly figure coming at him through the cloud of gas, then fired a second and a third dart, putting the figure down. Marine Spetsnaz personnel rose from their consoles, staggered blindly, eyes streaming tears, grabbing for belted weapons as they fell. The Harbormaster's Tower, with no bloodshed inside, belonged to the Marines, but it had to be secured. Darkwood hustled to the control panels. Mondragon closed the door leading to the steps.
Administer the injections and make certain they're disarmed and cuffed.
Yes, sir.
The Marines carried sedation kits and plastic disposable cuffs to bind the tower personnel hand and foot.
Mondragon, secure the tower! On the double!
Yes, sir. On the double now. You all know what to do!
Two of the Marines stripped off their penetration suits, revealing Soviet Marine Spetsnaz uniforms so they could replace the guards on the steps. They quickly slipped out the door and down the steps. No gunfire, no alarms, nothing to indicate the other raiding parties were faring poorly in their work seizing control of the other parts of the port facility. The gates to the mini-sub pens might already be closed.
Now the hard part.
Jason dropped into a seat at the sonar net controls and tried to determine which dials and switches to work to shut down just half of the sonar net. If he killed the entire net, alarms would automatically sound. If he killed the wrong side, the Reagan and the other vessels coming in after her would activate the sonar system and the entire underwater complex would be on alert. Darkwood rubbed his thumbs against the tips of his fingers, then reached for the controls.
Here goes.